For more than 30 years, Stephen Brody has studied the paranormal in everyday life, from extrasensory perception and psychokinesis to mediumship and materialization. The Gold Leaf Lady and Other Parapsychological Investigations is his latest work. We'll be back with Stephen in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Brody is a professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. His earliest research was in logic and the philosophies of language and time. He then moved on to the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of science, focusing especially on the evidence for psychic phenomena in the hope that it would provide new insights into traditional philosophical problems. He also turned his attention to hypnosis and multiple personality. Here he is on Coast to Coast. Stephen, how are you?
Well, I have a nasty cold, but I'm a trooper.
Oh, no. Okay, we're going to hold you on. We're going to shoot for three, but if you collapse on me, let me know.
I'm a trooper, not to worry.
Okay, very good. Tell me a little bit more about you. First-time guest, right?
I am, yes.
Okay, tell me.
Well, I think probably what would interest your listeners mostly is what got me involved in the study of psychic phenomena.
Okay.
And this is something that I had a pivotal experience back in graduate school. And in those days, I fancied myself to be a kind of hard-nosed materialist. It wasn't for any particularly good reason. It was just a kind of intellectual conceit I was cultivating in those days. And it was a slow day in Northampton, Massachusetts, as most of them were, and a couple friends came over and said, we'd seen the only movie in town, and they said, well, let's play this game called Table Up. And what they meant was, let's have a seance. And I'd never taken parapsychology seriously. I'd never thought about it, really. I didn't know anything about this. My friends said this was just a game. They didn't really know anything about parapsychology either. But they said, but they've tried it before, and when it worked, it was a lot of fun. So for the next 3 hours, to my surprise, I watched my table rise in the air and spell out answers in response to questions.
Now, when you began investigating the paranormal, did it conflict with your educational upbringing?
Absolutely. I mean, I knew at the time in grad school that there was no way I could really discuss this with my mentors. So I put it out of mind, literally put it out of mind. I put it on the back burner. I completed my PhD. I got a job. I published what I like to think are respectable articles in logic and the philosophy of language for about 6 years, and then I got tenure. And then I realized if I was really an honest scholar, I needed to think about what had happened to me back in grad school. And I knew that some very prominent philosophers had written about parapsychology, and so I figured I'd look at what they had written to see if there was anything worth sinking my teeth into. And I did, and I decided that there was. And then I decided if I was going to do a responsible job of this, that I needed to become a member of the the inner circle of academics and scientists who were studying the phenomena. And I did that. The rest, I guess, is history.
I'm sure you've looked at the work of Carl Jung, right?
Oh, sure.
And did you pick up techniques from philosophers and those who would study the world of the psychic realm and, you know, begin to put them together in your own beliefs?
Well, I guess I've been consolidating the work of a whole bunch of philosophers since I began my study of philosophy back in grad school. But I'd like to think that there's something that's more or less individual about the place I've arrived at.
Was it a major break for you when you started switching your interests professionally?
Well, it transformed my relationship with most of the people in my profession. And I was extremely naive. I really thought that scientists and academics were committed to discovering the truth.
Yeah.
And
they'd open up their arms to you, right?
Right. I naively thought that they'd actually be excited to learn that beliefs that they had held were wrong, so long as learning that brought them closer to the truth. I mean, that shows you how naive I was.
You learned the hard way, Stephen.
I did.
We all did. And at this point, I mean, you're still at the University of Maryland, right?
Still am, yes.
Okay, and do you still try to, are you teaching or just researching there?
No, I teach.
Okay.
And I get to teach once a year. I teach an upper-level philosophy seminar in philosophy and parapsychology.
Okay, but do you try to leak parapsychology into your daily teachings?
Well, not so much in my other
It's not like the curriculum.
No.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to change that, Stephen. We're going to have to go petition the dean or something like that.
Well, there's still a place for traditional philosophy classes, and, you know, I'd like to contribute to that as well.
Well, and you know, these great philosophers of the past, when you really think about it, I mean, they touched the paranormal, too. I mean, they tapped into something that's in the universe for their thought process. I'm convinced of that, aren't you?
Well, you may be right. I mean, I often wonder why people seem to overachieve in ways that they couldn't possibly have predicted. And, you know, I've studied savants and prodigies as well, and I think something similar is going on in those cases.
There is a litany of some of your work, and I just want to read some of these titles to people because they'll get a real good understanding, a little bit more of who you are, because we're going to talk about all these tonight. ESP and Psychokinesis, The Limits of Influence, Psychokinesis and the Philosophy of Science, First Person Plural, Multiple Personality and Philosophy of the Mind, Immortal Remains, The Evidence for Life After Death, and The Gold Leaf Lady. I'm going to save her, too, because that's a great title, and there's a story behind that. When you were doing your work and when you're getting degreed, did you ever come across a book called Breakthrough to Creativity, by any chance? By Shafika Caregula?
I know of it, but I must say I haven't read it.
She was my aunt.
Really?
Yes, and she was one of the first to devote her career. She was a practicing psychiatrist.
Right.
She was one of the first to just say, you know what, I'm done with this. I'm going into the power of the mind and what it does. And she started doing all that. Then she died, and there it died. But she was devoting her entire career, Stephen, into this area. She knew there was something else out there.
Well, I admire people who've taken that step, especially when it means that they might have to deal with the anger of their peers.
Did you find that when you studied ESP, psychokinesis, looking at evidence for life after death, that they all seem to have similarities?
Well, there are themes that I think run throughout the evidence in parapsychology, and that's part of what it's part of a bigger picture I'm still trying to put together.
What's your definition of ESP?
Well, it would be the awareness of thoughts or information or facts independently of the known senses. That's not a good definition, but that's pretty much all we can do. And there are two kinds of ESP, basically. There's telepathy, which is a kind of direct mind-to-mind interaction, and then there's clairvoyance, which has to do with the awareness of physically remote states of affairs.
Are you convinced that all of us have the ability for ESP?
I believe we all do. I'd say there's no conclusive evidence of that, but that's, for many researchers, that's still an open question. I mean, the fact is there are some people who are really, really good at it, and there are others who don't seem to do anything conspicuous at all in the way of ESP.
Now, why is that? I agree with you there, but why is that? How come some people have this incredible ability, other people just can't do it?
That's one of the big questions. I mean, it may be that the psychic superstars are like advanced yogis, that what yogis do is to control processes that we all undergo, but they can do it in conspicuous ways. So it may be, if that picture is right, that we're all using ESP and psychokinesis under the surface, but in ways that don't ordinarily call attention to themselves. But the psychic superstars are people who can harness this in some way that makes it more conspicuous. On the other hand, it might be like musical or athletic abilities, something that not everybody has.
Do you believe, though, that it's more of the conscious mind than it is the physical body that gets people to be tuned into this?
I actually think it might be more of the unconscious mind, and that's, and that's part of what I think many people find very scary about the possibility of psychic functioning.
Because to me, when it's in the unconscious, it means you can't control it.
Right, so it means that psychic functioning can be sneaky and naughty. And I think that's why psychokinesis scares people. I mean, that's very easy to explain. Let me try.
Do you believe that? Do you believe there are people who can practice psychokinesis?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. All right. Explain that.
Well, first of all, I don't know that there are too many people in industrialized cultures who do that. I think that's so at odds with the prevailing worldview and so terrifying. And here's the reason it's terrifying.
And Geller might be one of them, Uri Geller.
Yeah, possibly. The reason it's terrifying is this. If I can move, a pencil just a millimeter by thinking about it, then it's a very small step from doing that to making somebody drop dead by thought alone.
Yes.
So the existence of any psychokinesis at all forces us to take seriously a kind of magical worldview that most of us associate, usually condescendingly, only with so-called primitive cultures. And it's a worldview where we might have to take seriously things like hexing or the evil eye and assume responsibility for a whole range of occurrences that we'd just as soon be bystanders for.
What about people who concentrate en masse on any particular thing, using whatever powers they may have? Does that work?
There's some evidence that it might. The scary,
Sure.
part of that is that it could work in the other way, too. That is, I don't know anything that can be used exclusively for the good. So when a bunch of people get together to concentrate for some laudable goal, to try to heal somebody or to try to positively influence world affairs, for all we know, all the people who have negative thoughts are doing just the opposite, and it's just canceling each other out.
See, I have always believed, Stephen, that if somebody shoots negative thoughts, that eventually, though it could, it'll work. It'll come back and haunt them, too. And I've always wondered, you know, for example, how we are viewed as a nation around the world. The last several years, you know, if this were going to be a public relations test, we haven't fared too well, not in the eyes of the world, okay?
That's for sure.
And I've always wondered, why do these things happen to us as a nation? What if all these people have such animosity toward us as a government, as a country, and they're always thinking and bombarding us with these thoughts, right? And let's say this economic collapse, which is based mostly on greed, but nonetheless it collapsed.
Right.
What if these people who kept thinking these things about us, sending out these mind waves, what if they contributed to this? And down we go.
Well, I am in no position to rule it out, and I'm certainly open to it.
I mean, if people start doing that, God knows what could happen.
Well, but you're suggesting that they might pay a price just for having the negative thoughts.
I mean, eventually, it would be
nice.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be nice, I suppose, if there was that kind of cosmic justice. I haven't been convinced of that yet. I mean, some people seem to get away with being nasty folks all their lives.
What was the time span between, let's say, the ESP psychokinesis book and the Gold Leaf Lady book?
Wow.
Years?
Oh, yeah. ESP and psychokinesis, that was my first book. It was written in the late 1970s, and the Gold Leaf Lady was written just a few years ago.
All right. Well, let's start with the Gold Leaf Lady and work our way down.
Okay.
The Gold Leaf Lady. How in the heck did you come up with a title like that?
Well, it's a great case. It's probably the best case I ever personally investigated. And it's about a woman in Florida whose body would break out in this golden foil, this golden colored foil. And it would spontaneously break out in this. So I could be sitting across a dinner table from her, and suddenly there would be something on her face or on her hands or arms.
You mean like aluminum foil? But gold?
Thinner than that. It's almost like a thinner version of the wrapping on Hershey's Kisses. It's very thin. It's very clingy. And it would appear sometimes in just small quantities, sometimes in huge quantities and layers.
And it was gold-like, or it was actually
it was
gold-like.
Gold? No, it was not actually gold. It's actually brass.
I'm telling you, she'd be like the hen that laid the golden egg. We'd keep her somewhere and just
exactly
have her produce
right.
gold. So. Now, you witnessed this?
Yes, many times. And it's been witnessed by quite a few other people. I mean, that's part of what makes the case so interesting. It's very difficult to catch it because she doesn't control this. This, for her, is like an affliction.
So she gets like this sheen of this gold-looking material on her body.
I wouldn't even call it a sheen. I'd call it clumps. I mean, it's
all right.
sometimes.
Does she conjure it up, or does it just happen?
It just happens. For her, it's just a total pain in the ass. It's a complete affliction. She could be at the 7-Eleven trying to pay for something, and suddenly her face will break out in this stuff. She says she often wakes up with it in the morning all over her body, and her septic tank, she says, is filled with it.
What about her family? Any family history of this?
Apparently, there are some reports that one of her sons seems to have some ability. But the cool thing about this woman, her name is Katie, is that she's an all-around psychic, first of all. I mean, she works with the police to solve crimes. She seems to have some mediumistic abilities.
She's the real deal.
She's the real deal. She's functionally illiterate. She's dropped out of school in the second grade. But when she's in a mediumistic trance, she writes out quatrains from Nostradamus in medieval French and Latin.
That's remarkable. Okay,
it
so
remarkable.
This gold leaf material that pops up, what's it used for? I mean, why would that happen? Is there a purpose for it?
Yeah, here's the story. What you need to know about Katie is that she had no psychic ability she was aware of until she married her current and second husband.
Okay.
And it's a difficult marriage. And to me, Katie's case is a lot like what you see in classic poltergeist cases. Now, in a typical poltergeist case, you probably know the usual story is that you've got a disturbed teenager or adolescent, somebody with some deep emotional issues and no conventional way of expressing them or releasing them. And so the phenomena are like a kind of brute psychic flailing about. It's as if the teenager can't get rid of these feelings and just goes woof, and then things fly around or burst into flame or just shatter or something like that. Now, of course, teenagers and adolescents aren't the only people with serious emotional issues. Marriage is a fertile ground for that, as I can personally attest. And Katie's marriage to her current husband is very difficult. And hers is not the only case I've ever investigated where phenomena occur within the context of a troubled relationship.
Pretty toxic, then.
It is. In fact, can I digress for 1 second?
Sure.
There's a case I investigated in Maryland of a woman who gets images on photographic film. She points her camera wherever she wants, and there'll be cloudy masses, white cloudy masses, or spaghetti or noodle-like streaks. And she's in a marriage to a guy who's bipolar and who beats her and abuses her psychologically. And she showed me a picture she took of her husband, and he's glowering into the camera. And off to one side of his face are some white squiggles that spell out the word help, which I thought was pretty cool.
That is. That's weird.
What we don't know, of course, is whether it was produced by the woman or by her husband.
Right.
I mean, it could have been either.
Could
so
have.
Back to Katie. So,
okay.
So Katie is in this troubled marriage, and there were various poltergeist-like things happening to her in her house. So objects were moving around, objects disappearing and appearing. And one day, a carving set appeared out of nowhere, and her husband said to her, "What good is it if it isn't money?" And then 2 days later, her body started to break out in what looks like gold leaf. So if you want my obvious pop psychological analysis of this, it would be that symbolically this allows her to satisfy her husband's demand for something valuable, but she doesn't really have to be the goose that laid the golden egg and deal with the responsibility of that.
Foolish guy should have said something about diamonds or something.
You might have gotten a sapphire instead.
Yeah, that's true. But she's healthy? This doesn't hurt her?
No, it doesn't hurt, although she does feel kind of itching or irritation sometimes while it's happening or before it happens. So it's a kind of precursor. But when it happens, it appears spontaneously and instantaneously.
Let's talk a little bit more about the gold leaf lady, Stephen, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Want to sign up for our Coast Zone newsletter? It's free. All you got to do is go register for it now by going to Coast2TO, coasttocoastam.com. Right there's the feature story. Register for the Coast Zone free newsletter. And also, those of you who would like to subscribe to the After Dark magazine, you get 2 free CDs of an Art Bell interview with the late Father Malachi Martin. 2 different programs. So take advantage of that when you subscribe or renew your After Dark magazine. Also call 1-888-727-5505 for that. 1-888-727-5505 or online as well, coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Stephen Browdy. Stephen, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
You are. It rhymes with howdy.
Okay. Howdy, Mr. Browdy.
Right.
Let's go back to the Gold Leaf Lady, if you would, and then give me your conclusions of her. And I'm sure you've investigated these other cases, too. So this material comes out of her seemingly whenever she doesn't expect it.
Let me just stop you for one second,
if I may.
It looks like it comes out of her, but I'm not sure that's what's going on.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's part of what makes the case so interesting. The material is brass, and that means it's about 80% copper, 20% zinc. Now,
so it's been analyzed or checked?
Oh, yeah, I've had it analyzed in a whole bunch of places. We've looked at it for foreign substances of the kind that might have been used to fraudulently attach it to her body.
Okay.
Nothing was ever found.
No trickery here.
No trickery. One of the reasons I know there's no trickery is that, we've had magicians look at it. The stuff is very clingy. It's very difficult to move around. The way we usually investigated her was to have her go into a room. She lives in Florida, so she would be wearing a T-shirt, short sleeve shirt. We'd sit her down. We'd talk to her. We'd look at her very carefully. We'd inspect her hands, her arms. We'd have her lift up her shirt so we could see there was nothing on the inside of her shirt.
Open her mouth, all that. The works, right?
Right. And then at some point, the stuff would appear. And so people have seen it appear spontaneously. Now, if this was coming out of her, given the quantities that appears on her, she'd have to have, I think, lethal amounts of copper and zinc in her system. And blood work has never shown anything unusual in that respect.
Have people witnessed it coming out of her?
Well, they witnessed it appearing spontaneously on her. I'd rather put it that way. And I have. I mean, so it just suddenly, at one point, it's not there, and then suddenly it's there.
It's there. It's like she's shape-shifting or something.
Well, to me, look, one reason I think this case is so interesting is that I think it's on the level. And another reason I think the case is so interesting is that it's not clear how to classify it. It's unprecedented.
It's weird.
I know. Well, see, the two big options, as far as I can see, is one would be to say this is a materialization, that what Katie is doing is what physical mediums have been reported doing for quite some time, that is apparently materializing objects apparently out of nothing. The other possibility is that it's an apport, and an apport is where an object disappears from one location and appears spontaneously somewhere else. Now, if that's what's going on, then that means somebody's stash of brass foil is being raided.
Yeah.
But we don't know where that would be. I mean, you can buy the stuff commercially. It's a cheap way of putting gold leafing on frames in art supply stores.
Okay. It's that kind of material.
Yes.
All right. Now, when this happens to her, what is her state of mind? What is she doing?
I've been examining this case since the mid-1980s, and nobody I know who's been a part of this investigation has been able to find any clear regularity between what's going on in Katie's mind and when it happens. It could happen during periods of relative calm in her life. It could happen during traumatic times in her life. But it may be that it goes on for months at a time and then stops for months at a time. She seems to have no control over this. She has great control over the other things that she does psychically. But not this.
But not this. And it doesn't hurt her?
No, it just, it's
aggravating. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes instead of seeing the brass leaf appear on her, you'll see something like stigmata. It'll be in the shape of a cross or a butterfly.
That's strange. Or does the material disappear or does she have to take it off her?
Well, we just pick it off or scrape it off.
You have to scrape it off. Okay. Yeah. So it doesn't just like recede or anything like that.
No, that's why it doesn't look like a materialization, because from everything I've studied about materialization phenomena, when material materializes, it usually coalesces out of an initially cloudy mass and then goes back or withdraws or disappears somehow. But this stuff, that's how I've had it analyzed. I've got lots of it.
And are they, those people who do the analysis for you, are they baffled in terms of how it came to be? I mean, are they surprised at what it is, first of all? When they look at it, is it unusual when they analyze it?
Well, I had a classic incident with the material science department at Johns Hopkins University. I spoke to members of the department. I showed them a video of Katie. I showed them the material, and they were, as you can imagine, intrigued. And I wanted to have an analysis of the structure of it. And they were very excited about it. So they did an analysis, and they discovered that there was nothing anomalous about its underlying structure, that it had the same granular structure as ordinary pressed or rolled metallic leaf. And at that point, they lost interest. And in part, that annoyed me because...
They thought it was trickery.
Well, they figured that if it was really paranormal or paranormally produced, that there would have to be something wildly anomalous about
right.
its underlying structure.
A new property they've never found or
right.
anything like that.
And that just doesn't follow. On the other hand, I understand their perspective. They're material scientists. And so as material, there was nothing particularly interesting about it. The only thing that was interesting was about the way it came about. But there was nothing as material that piqued their interest.
Now, there's a company that somebody just emailed me that says it's called the Gold Leaf Company, and they sell this stuff, but it's gold leaves, actually.
Well, what you want to look for, if you look for this commercially, it would be something called Dutch metal or composition leaf. And I've had analytical chemists at my campus and also at NIST take a look at it. And what we were doing was an analysis of about 30 different samples from 30 different occasions, looking for similarities between them. And then we were going to do a control series, which we partially completed, of commercially available foil to see if there were any interesting similarities or differences. But for various reasons, that hasn't been completed yet.
Have you come to any conclusions about her?
Well, I think she, as a person and as a psychic, I think she's impeccable. She has no interest in being a professional psychic. She's never tried to profit from this. She is an intelligent person, just not educated. Katie has no particular view about the place of psychic functioning in the overall scheme of things. She thinks that the foil is due to Nostradamus. She has some sort of fixation on Nostradamus. I'm not sure. I think she saw a TV program once about
right. it. Right. Sure did. Done by Orson Welles. I think it was called The Man Who Knew Too Much.
It could be.
Something like that. All right. So now you've also investigated some other cases, Stephen, right, when you put this work together.
I have, yes.
What are some of the other fascinating ones?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of the cases I've investigated have turned out to be disappointing.
Disappointing in that?
Well, what I personally like to investigate myself are people who claim or appear to have the ability to manifest psychokinetic phenomena more or less regularly, because, as you can imagine, the philosophy department at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, doesn't have provisions in its budget for paranormal case investigations. So I can't afford to be sitting around allegedly haunted houses, for example, just waiting for something to happen. I've got to go to places where things are likely to happen. So one of the things I like to do is to investigate people who claim to have PK or psychokinetic abilities. And some of those cases, unfortunately, haven't panned out the way that I like. And sometimes I think the people have been frauds. Sometimes I think the cases have been sabotaged in other ways that are very interesting. And I wrote about some of those investigations in the book, The Gold Leaf Lady.
All right. These cases that you investigate, and you're disappointed in some, but not all, what keeps you moving? What keeps you driving through this?
What the primary thing I'd say is my study of historical cases that most people tend to dismiss, A, because they're old, and B, because allegedly they occurred in darkened seance rooms. I think the history of the heyday of spiritualism was a very interesting time in the U.S. and Europe. This was a period of about 75 years between 1855 and 1930. And during this period, there were mediums of all kinds. I mean, a lot of fraudulent ones, admittedly.
True.
But there were not only mental mediums, but there were physical mediums. Mediums who would not only materialize phenomena, but produce massive table levitations and other quite extraordinary things. And I found, to my surprise, I mean, for many years, I accepted the received view that this material was worthless, and that the only reasonable material in parapsychology would be the laboratory studies. And I've now completely changed my tune on that. I tend to regard the laboratory studies as relatively unimpressive and unilluminating and inherently unconvincing. And I now think that this stuff from the heyday of mediumship is actually the most important evidence in parapsychology. And so those cases have kept me going. Some of them, I think, are so spectacular that it actually makes me angry that people don't take them seriously. So I've spent a lot of time writing about those cases.
What do you think of eyewitness accounts? Do you get good ones? People who witness these things happening?
Fantastic accounts. And under exactly the right kinds of conditions for making accurate, for giving accurate eyewitness testimony. That is, the lighting was good. The phenomena didn't take the observers by surprise. The observers are often biased against them from the beginning, so you can't just chalk it up to people seeing what they wanted to see. Sometimes the observers were skilled conjurers and knew what to look for in the way of trickery. And often the phenomena lingered long enough for people to investigate them while they occurred. You want me to give you an example?
Of course.
Okay. Probably one of the greatest, maybe the greatest physical medium during this period was D.D. Hume, H-O-M-E.
Okay.
He was born in Scotland, went to the U.S. for a while, and he had tuberculosis, so his doctors inscrutably suggested that he move back to England, which goes to show that medical advice at the end of the 19th century was every bit as questionable as it is today. And Hume was a fantastic medium. He practiced mediumship for about 25 years. He was not once caught cheating. He would conduct seances at the spur of the moment in places he'd never before visited. So that completely rules out, in those cases, the hypothesis that he might have concealed a Confederate or planted an apparatus. And one of the people who investigated Hume was the physicist and chemist William Crookes. And one of Hume's regular phenomena was to make an accordion play melodies on request, sometimes when the accordion was held at the end away from the keys, and sometimes, according to reports, when it was just floating around the room or held by other people. Now, Hume claimed that the phenomena were strongest under the seance table. And admittedly, that to a cynic, that can sound suspicious.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
But Crookes was very clever and sensitive, and he realized that if this was really Hume's belief, it would be unwise to try to get him to produce the phenomena in a way that really took him out of his comfort zone. So here's what he did, and I think this is one of the classic experiments in parapsychology. First of all, he bought a new accordion for the occasion, so you can't say it was Hume's prop. Secondly, he went to Hume's apartment, watched him change clothes so he could make sure that Hume wasn't concealing some sort of musical device on his body, although this was 1871, so it's not clear what that would have been. Then he took Hume back to his house where he had prepared a wire and wooden cage that fit under his dining room table. There was enough, and the accordion was in the cage, so there was enough room for Hume to get his hand under the table and into the cage to hold the accordion at the end away from the keys. But there wasn't enough room for Hume to actually get his arm down there and actually manipulate the accordion. There were 9 observers present. There was good light in the room. There were 2 people stationed on either side of Hume to make sure he wasn't taking his feet out of his boots. And there was another observer stationed under the table with a lamp. And under those conditions, the accordion was seen to move about. The keys were depressed. Sounds came out of the accordion. Then Hume was instructed to take his hand out of the table, out of the cage, rather, put it on the table. The accordion was still flopping around inside the cage. An electric current was run through the cage, and the phenomena continued. Now, there's not a magician alive who can do that under conditions similar to those under which... Yeah. I mean, so if a magician says, oh, well, that can be done, I think the proper response is put up or shut up. There are a lot of... It's very easy to feign confidence about these things, and it's much harder to actually produce the phenomena.
Are you disappointed that science hasn't tried to study this in a more in-depth manner?
Hell, I'm disappointed that parapsychologists don't take it seriously. I've been lobbying within the parapsychological community for years to get some of the primarily laboratory-based researchers to look at this stuff. but well, I think I've had some success over the years, but not as much as I'd like. I still think there's a great deal of resistance.
Isn't there a little girl in Russia who can do some incredible psychokinesis things as well?
I don't know about a little girl. I mean, there was Nina Kulagina a number of years ago. This was a woman who seemed to have some psychokinetic abilities. But see, there was a big change that happened. Let me back up. One of the things people ask, and I think it's a reasonable question, is why did we see so many exotic, large-scale phenomena during this heyday of spiritualism and don't see it now? And I think a standard glib and incorrect answer to that is that, well, modern technology has simply made it impossible for mediums to get away with that kind of cheating. But I think that argument is a double-edged sword. I mean, technology has always been at the same level for cheaters and debunkers. So 19th century technology was perfectly adequate to uncover the tricks that could be produced in the 19th century. And in fact, hundreds and hundreds of fraudulent mediums were exposed then.
Well, Harry Houdini went through a lot of them, didn't he?
He did, and justifiably. I mean, this was a boon to opportunists, this particular period. But there were some excellent mediums nevertheless. Now, here's the difference. See, back in those days, the great psychic superstars really were spiritists. That is, they believed that they were not producing the phenomena, that they were just mediums, literally vessels for producing the phenomena. So psychologically, that takes them off the hook no matter what happened. So if only uninteresting phenomena or no phenomena occurred, the mediums didn't have to feel like failures. They didn't have to feel personally responsible. They could chalk it up to an inept communicator or to a weak link with the spirit world. And more important, maybe, is that when good phenomena occurred, the mediums didn't have to fear the extent of their powers. They didn't have to say to themselves, holy crap, if I can be doing this during the safe confines of a seance, who knows what I might be doing unconsciously when the seance is over. Now, in the, say, 1920s, 1930s, more and more people started taking seriously the idea that the mediums might be producing the phenomena rather than spirits.
Right.
And
right.
Even if the mediums didn't believe that themselves, that idea was in the air. It changed the psychology of mediumship. And I find it very suggestive that at about that same time, the phenomena started to get smaller in magnitude. And so by the time you get to people like Nina Kulagina in Russia and Felicia Paris in the U.S. in the mid-20th century, these were women who thought they were themselves producing the phenomena. And if you watch the films of these women, they sweat and strain to produce very, very small object movements. Now, how convenient is that from their psychological point of view? If they have to work so hard personally to produce such a small effect, then from their point of view, they'd have to suffer internal hemorrhaging before anything really serious happened.
Stephen, we're going to take this break, then we're going to come right back. I want to get your take on astrology, because you used to laugh at it, but not anymore.
Right.
And then why does this happen? There's got to be a purpose here for these things to occur. And then we talk about life after death a little bit later on Coast to Coast AM.